the future of all business is subscription. So it's like Microsoft Office used to be $200 a pop. And finally, a couple of years ago, they switched it to this like 365. Everyone's paying SaaS for Microsoft Office now. We're on subscription. Like groceries are increasingly on subscription. They started one at a time. Just Amazon Dash for your toilet paper. Then just this. Now just, whatever. Subscribe and save on 30 Shopify stores for all my protein bars and whatever. So everything moving to subscription economy. And that's from like Zora. I didn't make this up, right? And so that's the future of like the universe.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson. You're going deep.
Ryan, thank you so much for doing this. I'm really excited to be speaking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Aaron.
So I am actually breaking one of my rules today. I have a rule where literally for the last 2 years, every single interview that I've done has been in person, which has constrained me to basically primarily interviewing people in Pittsburgh and a few people in DC and New York for different business travel. I'm breaking the rule today because I'm just so excited to speak with you and to learn a little bit from you. You've already learned a lot from you and your micro private equity course. But to start things off, I'm curious to hear you elaborate for me in the audience, rules that you have as it either pertains to specifically investing or just other rules for life that you never agree to break.
Sure. So I suppose to back up a bit, we should first define investing from my context, which is not the buy 5% of a company and hope that one day it's worth a lot more. My version of investing is very active, usually buying small companies. And at the very least, I would like to have some sort of advisement. So I got into quote unquote finance a few years ago at a VC fund, and it was kind of frustrating how little control, how little influence we had over the companies we invested in. And that's kind of how I worked my way in and out of the finance world because I prefer to get my hands dirty. But when I think about it, I kind of think about like the legacy you're leaving on the companies that you choose to work with because your resources are limited. So for example, I would not invest or buy a big chunk of a small company that was a Me Too competitor and had just their path to dependence was just like the cheapest pricing and they were the latest entrant and they have the worst design, but they kind of are okay for their low value customers. That would be the opposite interest of interest to me. And so my approach has sort of been, if you're going to do something, it's kind of like the Jack Welch mantra when he was a GE, be number one or be number two or get out of the space. And so that's kind of been what I've been working on, whether it's a tiny little micro SaaS app. I need to be able to see a future for it where it is the best or else it's a waste of, I can't really say it's a waste of my time. Like I have 50 other better things to do, but it's not appealing to my, I guess my ego. It's not appealing to my philosophy that our resources are limited. Why are so many entrepreneurs doing things that have already been done really well? Why are people continuing to build landing page builders right now? Why are people making website builders? Like, why are people doing that? There's very few people who have the talent and the wherewithal to create stuff, especially to create stuff with like code. Why are they creating things that have already been done really, really well? And so I avoid those types of investments and I go for the ones where not only I can have an impact, my intersection of skills and passion and interests, but where the world like would go 0 to 1 for having it and not just like, oh, I'm a solution that can save $5 on. I'm a solution that's a little bit buggy, but it's cheaper. And that's typically how a lot of people get into technology or they get started, imitate before you create. But I just suggest to everyone to make that phase of your tech career as short as possible. Start creating sooner than you think you can, because next thing you know, you'll be way later and you'll still be kind of imitating and you won't have really innovated on anything. So that's all my personal philosophy with career and my choices for work. But it's definitely manifested itself into the way I want to invest in companies and buy them.
Yeah. Another one of the instances that you've spoken about that I found it just made a ton of sense was not exposing yourself to platform risk. So if you're something where a change of the Instagram API or algorithm can tank your business in a day, then you're really exposing yourself to kind of catastrophic risk. So I think it's fascinating as a framing of not exclusively pointing at the positive, but pointing at the things that you refuse to do in order to kind of eliminate mistakes and find success that way.
Yeah, that's a good, it's kind of timely too, because just a night or two ago, I was sitting at this table and staring up at the ceiling and thinking about platform risk and thinking about all types of risks. And I said out loud to the person I was hanging out with, I said, why don't we try to map out, visually map out all of the risks that we're aware of, sort of like the heuristic risks, not just my opinion, but like platform risk is a thing, right? I didn't invent platform risk. I just observe it and basically try to chart out the if given when workflows of you want to get into business, you want to be an entrepreneur. Well, which risks, like which risk path, which web are you willing to jump through? Which risks are tolerable to you or not? Because within each one is a spiderweb that then goes two more ways or sort of like a hydra. So for example, with platform risk, and you mentioned like the Instagram API, let's say I build an app on Shopify, and I've done this many, many times. I've built apps on Shopify. Well, you can build something that's like really nascent, like you embed Instagram images onto the homepage as a carousel. So it's like your platform risk is very low because Shopify is not going to compete with Instagram. And it doesn't really make money per se. So you're not close to the money. So Shopify is probably not going to replace you. But your platform risk is just that like nobody really cares. Like it's sort of like a vitamin. But you could go the other direction when you build your product on Shopify and say, we're going to do something that handles like subscription payments. And there are a couple leading apps. I won't say their names because I'm not hating on anyone. They're good apps, but there's a couple leading apps that do subscription payments on Shopify. So they are able to like capture all this value because they're so close to the money. They are the money. They hijack checkout. But then you go, well, their platform risk is actually more nuanced, not just because they're on Shopify, but because they're doing something that's so core to Shopify that it only makes sense. Shopify is going to murder them or buy them if they're very, very lucky, or replace them. And there's a kind of three options. They could murder them and not replace them. That happens sometimes too. They could replace them and murder them that way, or they could buy them. And so the closer you get to the money, and you could think of this as like Icarus, the closer you get to the sun, it's also you pick up the high risk, high reward, and the further away, low risk, low reward. So even within that loaded phrase, like platform risk, you can go down the web five different directions. And so finding these opportunities that are somewhere on the spectrum that you're comfortable with, where it's like, well, I get the benefits of being on top of a platform. So Shopify is going to drive me search traffic, some installs. They're going to handle payments and churn and all that. I'm going to take the good, but I'm not an Instagram image embedder, but I'm also not taking payments. Maybe I'm also not like doing coupons and discounts because that's very core to any e-commerce product. Maybe I'm somewhere in the middle. And then of course, where we land is the products that I'm working on in Shopify, Velo, cross-sell, et cetera. These are great marketing app products, but I wouldn't call them a no-brainer for every store. Right? FOMO has a point of view. Cross-sell has a point of view. Slack, something else like both has a point of view. Not every store needs them, wants them, and that's okay. And that's better for us. That's now de-risked us from being taken over or killed by Shopify because we're not some obvious must-have econ core feature like discounts, orders, receipt printers, confirmation, shipping tracking. Those are all tempting opportunities to the layman or to the first timer who's saying, let me build an app. Let me just do what everybody needs. Let me increase my total addressable market. But if your total addressable market is equal or greater than the platform you're building on top of, you've also just put yourself in their crosshair. So you're riding very close to the sun. And I think you do that. You need more luck. You need more business development, suave. You need a lot more things to not kind of have the rug pulled out from under you the way it happened with Meerkat when Twitter decided we're shutting you down and we're taking Periscope. And that's the thing. Like there's nothing Meerkat could have done from a technology side or whatever to prevent. That was just a people thing. And that people thing could have been avoided if they chose not to get that close to the sun with their platform.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting how much understanding the business models, it really almost what you articulate is like being empathetic to what are the Shopify executives and leaders going to be focusing on? They're certainly going to be looking to expand their revenue and their business. And subscriptions is a very kind of low barrier, low friction avenue to them accomplishing their goals. And across the board, that can inform both personal and professional decisions in every facet of your life. So if you're complaining or confused as to why your Ubers and Lyfts cost more now, well, we're in a completely different phase of that company. It's no longer rides subsidized by venture capitalists. It's executives who are under the watchful eye of public markets on a 90-day rolling basis, and they need to extract more profits and have better margins in order to continue to maintain their jobs and their compensation. And I think that goes in so many different directions. We see it. One of the things that we do with my company is help with marketing on LinkedIn. And part of the framework there is Microsoft is putting a ton of resources behind building out that social platform because they're trying to do battle with Facebook and Google and all these other platforms that already have their attention platform in place. And that's why there's so much investment happening there. But you wouldn't recognize that opportunity if you didn't understand the underlying business model behind those decisions.
Well, that's where you also have to kind of have, you have to develop a separate muscle almost, a separate idea muscle of looking at just markets and where you think everything is going. So back to the Shopify example, and I'm going to also talk about the Uber example. I think there's a great point to be made that's equal but separate on both of them. The Shopify example, look, the future of all business is subscription. So it's like Microsoft Office used to be $200 a pop. And finally, a couple of years ago, they switched it to this like 365. Everyone's paying SaaS for Microsoft Office now. We're on subscription. Like groceries are increasingly on subscription. They started one at a time. Just the Amazon Dash for your toilet paper. Then just this. Now just, whatever. Subscribe and save on 30 Shopify stores for all like protein bars and whatever. So everything's moving to subscription economy. And that's from like Zuora. I didn't make this up, right? And so that's the future of like the universe. So then you look back at Shopify and you say, well, I'm pretty sure Shopify wants to be the leading e-commerce white label provider in 100 years. Therefore, we can already ascertain with really certainty that they will need subscription payments built in. Not because subscription payment is a way to make money. We can see that on the bottom line right now, and they can see that. They get to see all the revenue of all of their subscription payment apps that are using them. But because it's the future of the universe. So it's like, now we're even closer to the sun, we're already melting. And if we zoom out a little bit from right now, 2020, whatever, you zoom out and you go, oh, like some of these products, they never really have a chance in terms of lasting for a long time because they were just stopgaps. They were just like experiments that the Shopify's of the world are just kind of, in my opinion, chuckling. You're like, yeah, let's let them build it out. Let's let them write 300,000 lines of custom JavaScript on 30,000 stores and have to have like 30 support engineers and they're still 7 days behind every implementation. This is what I've heard. And then once we see the patterns, we can squint test and abstract what are the five principles that every subscription store needs? What's the data model look like? They're just going to drop it in. And again, they might buy one of these companies and that'd be great, I guess. That'd be great for everybody.
For that one company, not for the other ones doing it.
Yeah, exactly. They're not going to buy all the companies. That's the other thing. Even if you have 100% chance of saying, as a technologist, no, my tech is too sophisticated, which many people overestimate the sophistication of tech. And even if that was true, you have 100 patents, you still have to acknowledge what you're saying. Well, there's five of you. So you're still at best 20% chance. So very, very scary. Then back to Uber, in addition to them going public, so now you're not getting VC subsidized rides, they're having to bet on the future that they've already impacted, let's say, yours and mine interest in owning a car. Like I haven't owned a car for 7 years. And so Uber kind of knows that now. It's like they can look at my rides and your rides and go, if they've taken 20 Ubers a month for 4 years, we're 97.8% sure, according to our data science, that they do not own a car. Therefore, if we jack up our prices 18%, what's the sensitivity analysis? How likely are they to finally say, oh, my Uber's too expensive. I'm just going to go buy a $20,000 car or more. They probably have the science on that too. And so as Jeff Bezos says, by thinking and focusing on things that don't change, things about human nature, things about like where the markets are headed, the obvious inevitabilities, whether they're good or bad at the micro level by developing technology that points towards the future versus just responding to right now, you really win. But so the right entrepreneur, all of that being said, building seasonal businesses where you get in and get out very quickly is a thing. There's a lot of niche content sites doing that. It's just not my thing.
So I'm really curious, relating this back to the micro private equity model, and you've used some language here, total addressable market. Like these are very common in venture-backed businesses. Not that all businesses aren't aiming to get big, but even the name micro PE kind of speaks to a certain size and scope. Is there a degree to which outside of the risk associated with platforms and competition being just what are their incentives, where are the opportunities, is there a degree to which you're just playing in an arena where I don't want to say like the competition is necessarily just less talented, but less sophisticated, less backed with resources, where maybe it's just the single developer or the single solopreneur who's not able to even make as informed of a decision from not having done those deals or having that framework where you could see other founders who've, I've sold a company, raised two rounds of venture capital and sold it. did it again. And so I know the playbook. I know how to extract the most value for everyone involved. And you're just kind of playing in a different arena without the experience and the savvy.
Yes. So a few things. First, I heard it said a few months ago. I don't know who said it, maybe a VC. And I agree with him. And I rarely agree with VCs because I think most of them are retards. But they on Twitter, they said, you know, the most sophisticated marketers in the world are digital marketers, right? It's really like marketers who work in technology companies, not necessarily a startup. I'm not trying to say it, the uncool hit people that play ping pong, but the most sophisticated marketers, the most sophisticated people at getting, exposing the perfect message in front of the right group of people are digital marketers. And so when you realize that digital marketers, there's not actually that many of us. We're all in a bubble on Twitter sphere. We feel like everyone's a digital marketer who read nonfiction and knows Ray Dalio's principles forward and back, but like nobody does. Nobody's heard of any of this stuff. Generally speaking, there's more truck drivers in America than there are like digital marketers in the world, whatever the case may be. And so you look at that and you say, now compare this to a local mom and pop mechanic shop where they're highly talented. Probably the average mechanic is more talented than the average marketer. They have real skills. Average marketers just like read blog posts 2 hours a day and put money into Facebook. But these people have real skills, but their skills are so incongruent with the skills that the average marketer has, where you get this multiplier effect of like a decent, almost like junior, decent SEO focused content marketer times like multiplied with a Rick's auto body shop in Iowa. It's like game over. Rick is going to win. Rick is going to beat every other auto body shop. Even if his ability to switch out a carburetor, I don't even know if that's a thing, even if his abilities are inferior, because his like outcome of like junior marketing plus him time multiplied by him is going to be insane. Whereas that junior marketer multiplied with one of 30 startups competing for the same customer base, like FOMO versus our 35 competitors, it's like so much more of a grind. And so I think marketers are realizing this to some degree. It's like, hey, everybody wants to be a big fish, just a little pond. So if you can't like hack it in the big leagues, that's one way to look at it. And I don't mean that in a mean way. Just it's actually just a savvy thing to do. If you're not loving your career's trajectory and you're trying to be in high tech, it's like, well, maybe what you think are mediocre skills would blow away 99% of other people who are in industries that aren't so easily intersected with your skills, and your impact will be much higher leverage. And that's really what it's all about. It's finding out where do your skills have the most leverage. Me as a marketer, I've learned that I'm not the best marketer. But then when I got into programming, I learned that when I combine marketing and programming, I'm like on a different level. I'm not even saying higher level, but it's just a different level. So it's like when I was a marketer, there were 10 million. If I did programming, there's 10 million. If I do marketing and programming at the same time in live stream, like there's 37 people who do that. And so it's kind of that phrase that Naval said, it's like to be the best at something, you got to start by being the only at something. And so I do think there's a lot of advantages in taking high-tech marketing skills where you're basically practice batting with a donut on, and then you're like, drop it off and go work on a Rick's auto body shop. And it's just, again, game over. And you can almost make it cyclical where you go in and out of the really competitive industry and get your ass beaten and then go back to where like you're the big dog, the BMOC, and kind of learn to be a leader, learn to manage and print cash. And then you can go back and forth. And I've done that as well. I mean, my wife's mom has a foot spa in Austin. Guess how it ranks on Google and Yelp? Number one. It's not even close. And we spend like 10 hours on a WordPress and keyword research, setting up the profiles on Foursquare and Yelp or whatever. Do any of the other foot spas in Austin have like a tenth of the, again, I'm not saying I'm talented, but like the talent as like an objective measure? Like they don't have people with Silicon Valley experience who've worked at 30 startups, who've spent big budgets from VC bank accounts to learn these skills to apply to their spas. So there's a huge opportunity there. But I think the other thing to think about here with micro PE versus VC backed, and like, how do you distinguish between and what should I go into or how should I think about it? Is for VC-backed companies to succeed, not only does the total addressable market have to be huge, so they have to be able to show this many billions is being spent. And not only that, they have to also show that in 5 years, this many more billions will be spent so the market's growing. But they also have to be able to show and demonstrate that their mere existence makes the total addressable market bigger. So like Uber, when this analysis came out a couple of years ago, if you recall, this like economist, and most economists are frauds, was like, oh, Uber could never be worth this much. This is like my master analysis of how much they could possibly ever be worth. He was forgetting that like Uber, it's going to be responsible for cannibalizing the ownership of hundreds of millions of cars if their vision is achieved. And so the total addressable market size for Uber, we can't even calculate now because Uber itself will change what the total addressable market looks like. Now switch back over to micro PE. I think a lot of times it means that you're buying a company, you're trying to figure out, is this VC fundable? Should I raise money? Should I hold it forever? How quickly should it be growing for it to not be considered a failure? Micro PE is when you buy a company where like the total addressable market is pretty fixed. And if it's growing simply as a function of the population's growing. And if it's growing, it's definitely not growing because of like your input. You're just serving an existing need. You're not like creating new demand. And so I think if you can look at a business or opportunity and say, okay, yeah, I get it. Like I'm working with florists and there's 50,000 florists registered, blah, blah, blah. Next year, there will be 52,000, but not because I'm going to make a training course and train 2,000 people, just because the population got bigger. That's that kind of business. And when you go the other route, you have to be prepared and have conviction that the market will be bigger because of you.
Yeah. Quickly on the economics point, the best explanation I've heard of the value of an economic analysis or degree is that it's effective at looking back because you can just kind of piece apart how incentives played into a certain result happening, but it is just utter garbage at predicting the future in any way, shape, or form because the future is unknowable. And that's been a really helpful framework for me. But back to the point of the person maybe leaving tech or leaving Silicon Valley to go enter a different industry or arena where there's less competition, You said something offhand. It was almost like everyone wants to be a big fish in a small pond. I think people's ego, it gets in the way of that, where you feel like I have to be the best of the best in this thing that I've chosen, or I have to win on the biggest stage on the biggest field in order to like validate whatever story it is that I'm telling about myself. But as you can piece apart that and kind of strip that down to what's the most pragmatic move here, and I'm guessing this is similar to you eventually leaving Silicon Valley in the VC world of where can I just win? Like, where does the win happen regardless of how that might be perceived externally or just my own internal narrative?
It starts with self-awareness. And that's why, and I could say that anyone, when someone says like, well, you gotta be self-aware, they instantly look like an asshole for saying that. But I said a minute ago, right? Like I realized I'm not a very good marketer. I'm not a very good programmer. But you do both together and people are like, their brains explode because they don't think that you're allowed to have both skills.
Yeah.
Or one way or the other, people believe in predestination and people definitely don't believe in themselves on average for most people I've met. And so you have to be self-aware. That was me being self-aware and then figuring out, well, what can I do about it? So it's like the old, there's so many cliches here, right? Deal life with the cards you've been dealt and whatever the phrase is. And that's what you have to do with your career. But I guess I agree with you. A lot of people say, I've read enough blog posts, I've listened to Kanye West songs, and I have to be the best of the best of the best. I don't want to be a protege, I don't want anything else. And that's okay. And some people will pull it off, but you probably won't. And that's okay too. But you have to first kind of like level up one at a time. So you don't go zero to marketing and a programmer. You go zero to like a bad programmer or zero to a bad marketer. And then you go from like bad marketer who loves a lot of shows on Netflix to like bad marketer who stopped watching Netflix so that it could be also become a bad programmer. And so you start making all these leaps. And through that process, you're leveling up. You're like standing taller. Your posture increases because your confidence increases. Next thing you know, you feel like you can do anything. And once you feel you can do anything, you tell yourself that enough times, you believe it, and then it becomes true. Like that's the process. Tell yourself something, it internalizes, you believe it, and then it happens. It's happened in my life. It's happened in many other people who I've observed. But yeah, I mean, some people would rather trip over themselves. And those are not the people that I keep in my circle because I think they're the types of people who have this mindset that says anything that happens and that's not good is because of bad luck and circumstance and other people and victim mentality. And anything that happens that is good is because of their own good deeds. Instead, we should say, let's increase, someone else said this, I'm not making up any of the good things I'm saying today, but let's increase our luck surface area. So increasing your luck surface area is like exposing yourselves to things that could be good, whether that's a Codecademy course or like a networking event on Thursday, and you'd rather be at home with your dog. You have to increase your luck surface area. You have to believe in yourself. But, you know, not everyone's going to do that. And that's why there's 7 billion people and there's one Steve Jobs and there's one Jeff Bezos, there's one Elon Musk, because to be an anomaly, you have to be an anomaly, right? But hopefully the impact I'm hoping to make with people I work with, not necessarily like products I'm working on or inanimate objects or money or anything like that, but just people I work with one-on-one my hope is to encourage more people to just believe in themselves, and everything else takes care of itself.
Yeah. And I've basically learned this from sports and I'm now applying it to business, which is the fact that it is hard is the thing that should get you excited. Like, it was hard to go do the extra track workout. It's hard to spend the extra half hour on the practice field, or conversely, just how you illustrated for your own professional career. It's like, it's exciting that as you're doing it, the competition isn't, that the other parties aren't. And you can call that a psychological trick. You can call it a delusion, a hallucination, whatever you want to, but it is a really effective way at getting through those more, maybe more difficult moments and continuing until it's a habit and a general practice.
That's exactly right. I used to use that phrasing, basically you just said as a hashtag, like hashtag most people won't, because they won't. Yeah. And that other phrase about entrepreneurship or being successful in this way, do what others can't, do what others will to live like others can't, and encompasses or encapsulates the entire concept. So when you're working out, it's very normal when you're at the gym and you're on rep 10 and you told yourself, I wanted to 12. Your premeditated, non-tired, non-lactic buildup state was, I'm going to do 12. And now you're in the 10th and you're like, yeah, but I want to stop because I'm tired now. But then at the gym, we're able to kind of tell ourselves like, well, no, this is, these last two are where you're going to get, you're going to cut yourself and everything's going to be great. You're going to get bigger tomorrow and be able to take care of someone on the street. So we can tell ourselves that at the gym. But then when we're doing that with mental challenges, when we're like working at 5:30 p.m., God forbid, and we really want to go home because we technically are safe to leave at 5 and we can't push 20 more minutes. Like, why are we not treating that the exact same way as when we have 2 reps left at the gym? And so the really successful people I know, that is how they operate. Once the going gets tough from that mental perspective, either it's longer hours or just the problem you're solving is tough, doesn't always have to equate to longer hours and more sleep. Whatever it is, once you get to your mental threshold, pushing through that is the same exact difference as pushing through building physical muscle. But for some reason, the trend is that when we're up against our limits mentally, some other background job in our head says like, oh, well, now we definitely should stop. And it doesn't apply physically. So I haven't cracked the nut on that yet, but hopefully that perspective might help a couple people so that you catch yourself the next time you're mentally strained and you say, well, let me go eat a sandwich. Let me go turn on TV or open up YouTube or watch a cat video. You can actually go, oh, huh, this is that moment where I would be leveling up right now. This is that moment where I'd be doing things that hashtag most people won't. This is the moment of the day. If I'm in New York City and I'm in WeWork and everyone's trickling out at 4:15 p.m. after having their beer, after having their free beer, if I stay, if I just do that little more thing, if I just do a little more customer support, if I just crack open Codecademy and resume my lesson from yesterday, most people won't, which means tomorrow I'll be 1% better than I was today, which means I'll be 1% better than most people. And you only need to be marginally more talented than most people to essentially be a rock star, right? So again, back to this intersection of skills, I'm okay at marketing, I'm okay at programming, but most people don't do both. And so now I've been doing these live streams and people are messaging me daily saying, you know, I watched your stream and it encouraged me. I started learning to code, or I took off last weekend or I told my wife and I did 7 lessons on Codecademy. This is happening daily now. It's not because they saw anything that good, because they saw something that was interesting, which was this intersection of otherwise mediocrity.
Yeah. And I think it's just so powerful too, like who you're even watching and who you're taking in. If you're Netflix, YouTube, wherever the attention may have gone, if you're following a bad example versus just keeping your eyes keyed on the people who are executing, it kind of just raises the Overton window or the bar for what pace you're going to be trying to go. But on the theme of 1% compounding of specific skills and the intersection of specific skills. So before we started talking, I wrote down coding and marketing. You're very good at kind of explaining to people that you've put those two together to great success. I, from consuming the course and just understanding a little bit more about all the things that you have your hands in, recognized 2 more kind of skills that to me seem essential to do what you do. One being negotiation, and the second being basically analysis. And whether it's analysis of the risks or just the hardcore kind of financial modeling associated with acquiring a specific company or going after a specific market to make good decisions. And I was hoping to actually hear you expand a little bit more on those 2 skills specifically.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. I'm actually working on some new negotiation lectures right now, because I think the course is almost weakest in the tactical approach to negotiation. Most of what I've learned in the theoretical sense has been from three books, and I mention these books all over the place. Usually I mention them with my affiliate links and then I make 10 cents if you buy it. But those are Getting to Yes from the Harvard Negotiation Project guys, Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. That's the most recent one. It's kind of very popular now. And Negotiation Genius, which has a lot of interesting case studies, such as how to negotiate from a point of weakness, and which sounds counterintuitive. You always think, well, the winner in negotiation is the one with more leverage. You can actually turn less leverage into more leverage. And there's a lot of tips to do that. So those are my classical training. And then my School of Hard Knocks training is just trying to always get what I want in life, dating back to when I was 11 and I was selling popsicles at the neighborhood pavilion pool, and someone would walk by and I would say, do you want to buy something? Like a total solicitor jerk, because I didn't know any better. So I've always had to kind of try to negotiate in that sense. But I would say if I had to sum it up now before some of these lectures are live, and I'm not pitching anyone, but just before I put the thoughts together better, to me, negotiation, being a good negotiator tactically starts with believing in everything that you're saying. And that's also like a symptom of problems like narcissism and blah, blah, blah. But put all that aside, because right now we're negotiating and you're trying to get what you want. You have to believe what you're saying. Because if you don't believe what you're saying, there's something in like the tones. Humans have the sixth sense for picking up on. But you talk to someone, you say later, they sounded nervous. They seemed shy. They seemed reserved. They seemed socially maybe inept, or they had awkwardness. You can pick up on these things. They're like that high pitched Don tone thing. Like we just pick up on them. And so you have to believe everything you say, because that's going to help instill confidence and add like a layer, like a smothering suave amplifier to all of your ideas. And then in my opinion, and what I've started talking about in the course, and this is how I live my life, is developing a reputation for speed. So when you're negotiating, being very quick to make an offer, very quick to counter an offer, very quick to show your work and explain, very quick to say no, very quick to push back with questions. All of those kinds of elements sound and are simple, but they're not easy. A lot of people drag out every negotiation, whether it's like, I hear all the time, 22-year-old kids, they're finishing from a great school, they're lining up all their job fairs, they're getting job offers, and they all sit back and lounge at their Ivy League cigar bar, and they're like, well, I'm debating whether to take the Harvard, the Google offer, but I think I might want to go work at Tesla for a while. And everybody's listening to these champagne problem conversations, and they kind of relish in like taking their time. But I think those are the people that when you start your career off by like delaying negotiations, it teaches you bad lessons about how to get what you want. Because in those situations, they're on the receiving end. But to gain leverage in our careers, we have to stop waiting for things to happen to us. You're only going to graduate from school and like go to a structured job fair and get offers once, if ever. I didn't get that, but some people will. The rest of your life, you have to be the hunter. You have to go out there. And hunters cannot wait around while the prey just lollygags in front of them. It doesn't happen. Hunters have to kill. And so part of that negotiation muscle is you have to be fast. And it's sort of like a merge of hustle cold, but merged into articulated box figures, like you said, doing spreadsheet models, proving your work, showing math. But speed and believing everything you say, in my opinion, are two really fantastic starting points to getting what you want out of a negotiation. So we're talking about buying companies, but that could also mean, where do you go for dinner with your girlfriend? It could mean a lot of different things. Being really quick and being really forthright and convicted. That's number one and two.
Yeah. And that, it really, you just articulated sales. Like the book To Sell as Human has had a massive impact on me. And it's basically saying how you're not in a sales role by title, but you're selling regardless. You're either selling internally to your organization or in this case, in the negotiation. And speed, I've learned that to a fascinating degree over the last year of how important that is in closing some of the deals that we've closed for Piper. It's, we got the proposal to you within 24, 48 hours after having the meeting where we discussed doing business together. You said yes, the sales agreement's in your inbox later that day. And you can take it down some sort of cynical rabbit hole, but it's like, if you don't do that, you're giving the person time to like get buyer's remorse, question their decision, as opposed to getting into it and getting the thing done.
Yeah. And the thing is, like you said, there's a cynical rabbit hole to go down. What's the right balance between getting the commitment now versus letting people quote unquote think about it or sleep on it? But for example, if they've ever gone and done something that's kind of a thrill, like cliff jumping or skydiving, right? Like you have to make the decision super quickly or you'll never do it. I've stood it on bridges 50 feet above the water and the cliffs and kind of you hesitate the first few times. And then, but once you do it, it's great. And so you have to believe as that salesman, as that negotiator, as the hunter, that if this person jumps with you, like they're going to not regret it later. And now your job so that they don't regret it later, so that the water is like deep and not shallow, if you want to stay in metaphor. If you don't do that, then yeah, you're a bad person. But if you're really confident that you're going to help them and you have the facts and figures to prove it and yada, yada, then I think it's almost like your moral obligation to get it done quickly because it's going to be better for them. Otherwise, they go home and they never got to jump off the cliff. They stayed on the plane and missed their landing zone for the skydive. And so some of life's most important decisions, ironically or counterintuitively, we actually have to make very quickly at the micro level, like what we do on the weekends for fun, and even at the macro level, like the moment you decide you're going to ask someone to marry you. That's like actually kind of a very quick decision. You can think about it for a while, but the decision itself will take place in about 2 seconds. And that's going to impact the rest of your life. And then we spend 10 minutes thinking about whether we want Taco Bell or Wendy's when obviously Taco Bell is a lot better. So,
jeez, I'm not going to get into that debate with you now. But before we aim towards wrapping up here, Ryan, one of the other elements, and you basically alluded to it there, is you have an account, dishonest marketing. And this concept that the charlatans in every field, but in marketing, it can be particularly prevalent. The reason I feel confident to act quickly in the deals that I make is because at Piper, we literally only sell our own dog food. If it hasn't worked for us, if we haven't done it ourselves, we refuse to sell it as a service, even when people ask us to do it. We're like, actually, we don't do SEM, but like, here's Brad. That's literally all he focuses on, so on and so forth. And so I'm really curious for you. I know some of the story behind it, but particularly for the audience here, the impetus behind you starting the account and just in general, like I'm going to drop one more compliment on you, the fearlessness to point out the fraud or the charlatan when you see that, where some people just stay silent and not necessarily stick out their own neck, stick out their own reputation and identity in the face of that thing that they're seeing.
First, let's talk about why this needs to exist. Why do we need a Twitter account that calls out dishonest marketing charlatans? Why do we need a website that accompanies the account called honestmarketer.com that shows how to not be a charlatan? Why do we need that? Well, because entrepreneurs or marketers specifically are the mouthpiece by which products that could change the world, change the world. So you can invent a cure for cancer. If you don't submit it to the right labs, you're not going to cure any cancer. And so that's the macro, that's the extreme level. But on the much smaller level, that's what's happening every day. People are able to build great products that save us time, make us money, make us happier, et cetera. And they might do that. They might do it. They might build it, but nobody uses it because they don't have the right marketing. And so marketers kind of have this like responsibility to the world in a way to disseminate information and to share the best products that are going to make everybody's lives better. That's like the bottom line to me. And so when marketers aren't holding up that responsibility, or they're sort of bastardizing it or abusing it for their own personal quick gains, the whole world suffers. And so it's not just like, oh, I'm Acme Co. and I don't like that Vandalay Industries lies in their marketing and they make a little more money than I do. Everyone's upset when that happens, and that's fine. But that's between you and them. What's really morally reprehensible is that the rest of the world doesn't get to benefit from Acme Co.'s superior product, service, et cetera, because they're being persuaded by Vandalay Industries lies. And so we started Dishonest Marketing on Twitter. We started honestmarketer.com. That's the kind of the companion site with guides about how to be honest. And in terms of what you said about fearlessness, I think that's also an obligation of ours. I got that directly from Nassim Taleb. If you see fraud and do not say fraud, you are fraud. And so I see all the time marketers on Twitter sharing a screenshot of some bad cold email or abusive cold email where they've already unsubscribed. And they're always blurring out the person's name and email. And I always reply. I'm replying 3 times a week. Publish their name and email. And they're like, oh, I don't want to dox people. It's like, it's not doxing. This is like justice. If you sued them, their information would be public, including their home address. Just publish their name and email, man. They're sending this email to 10,000 people. It's not like anyone's going to see it who hasn't already gotten it in their inbox. And so I'm encouraging more of that. If we didn't share exactly who the perpetrators were of dishonest marketing, which is what we're doing all the time, I think we would almost be part of the problem, because we would be leveraging dishonesty to create our own ego or something like that as like holier than thou. Whereas instead we're saying, here's our principles. And just like you mentioned, Aaron, we have 4 principles, we have 7 guides. All of those are lived out on all of our website. All of my personal side projects are like in compliance with honestmarketer.com principles. So we're not selling anything that we're not doing ourselves. And we can't expect anything from others that we don't expect from ourselves. The impetus of all of it, tactically speaking, why do we launch all this? Because FOMO, in 2016, when we launched, we created our vision and it hasn't changed, not one character, one word since. And it's FOMO's vision is to give honest entrepreneurs the credibility they deserve. And so you can't do that if we don't do our part to clean out the charlatans that are out there.
That's beautiful and an excellent note for us to wrap up on. I am confident that the audience is going to want to learn even more about you, Ryan, and connect with you in the digital world to continue to follow along. What coordinates can we provide people who want to learn more?
Sure. So I mostly tweet. I do not have LinkedIn, Facebook, Snapchat, or Ashley Madison profiles. But you can go to Twitter, Ryan C. Culp. That's K-U-L-P, German spelling, not the in front of Chili's when they type C-U-L-P and then I have to correct them and they change the C to a K. And you can also check me out at ryanckulp.com. A little bit about what Aaron and I have been discussing tonight has been alluding to my latest course about buying small companies, even buying small companies with no money upfront. And you can check that out at microacquisitions.com.
Beautiful. We're going to link that all in the show notes. goingdeepwitharon.com/podcast is the place to find it, or in the podcast app where you're probably listening to this right now. But as we do at the end of each conversation, Ryan, I want to leave on a point of action and give you the mic one more time to issue an actionable personal challenge for the audience.
Okay. So not to be contrarian, because action means an addition to something, but I want to promote or suggest that you work via negativa. So I want you to, your actionable item tonight, tomorrow, this weekend, to be to not watch Netflix and then see what happens with that block of time. See what you do. You might go running. You might just sleep. You might hang out with people that you care about, or you might start the next side project and 6 months later, quit your job and then write a case study about it on Indie Hackers. So just do not watch Netflix for a week or two. That's your action item. And just see what happens in those at the time.
Beautiful. This has been absolutely fantastic. Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Aaron.
We just went deep with Ryan Culp. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Thank you for watching all the way to the end of my interview with Ryan Culp. He is buying a ton of businesses. My company, Piper, wants to start buying businesses, but I'm curious, what type of business are you interested in purchasing? Let me know in the comments below.